And now, welcome to Who's Talking on WCHL with D.G. Martin. Interesting guests, enlightening conversation. And now, here's your host, D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. What's happening over there in Raleigh, and how is it going to impact Chapel Hill? Are there going to be more cuts or more taxes? And will the Republicans... have they got control of state government, not just for the next year, but for the next 10 years? Who's going to win the presidential election in North Carolina and the governor's race? Well, the person I go to who I know has his finger on the pulse of North Carolina better than anybody else is Scott Mooneyham, who's the editor of The Insider and the statewide columnist for a group of North Carolina newspapers, the Capital Press Association. So he's a go-to person when I have questions like this. And Scott, you're busy, but you've agreed to visit with us here in Chapel Hill for a few minutes.
Oh, I'm never too busy to talk to you, DJ. Good to be here.
You're mighty nice. I don't know where to start, but I thought we might start with the Chapel Hill people who are in the news. One of them just recently in The Insider, you've reported about one of our state legislators, Bill Faison, who seems to be flirting with the idea of running for governor this year and maybe in the Democratic primary, and is stumping around the state. And there's some news recently having to do with a tax proposal, funding proposal for education.
That's right.
Tell us about Bill Faison as you see him from Raleigh, and how's he doing throughout the rest of the state?
Well, he is certainly really for several months. He's been as you say, thumping around about potentially running for governor, though he has not put it that way. But the signs were obvious to anyone who watches this kind of thing that he's been making some very critical comments about Governor Beverly Perdue. And so whenever a fellow Democrat does that, you know that they are considering a run for governor, considering, you know, potentially challenging her. But as I point out, he has not said yet that that is his intention. And to be honest, I'm not sure that it is. I'm not sure that he may be hoping to be one more factor that might convince Governor Perdue not to seek a second term. You know, maybe that's his real design. I guess we will find out, assuming the elections take place as they are scheduled. And that is no guarantee, because this is the 10-year redistricting cycle, and there have been lawsuits filed, and who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, I'm going to talk to you about that later on. Yeah.
But as you mentioned, the governor has come out and said that she would like to see the sales tax increase, which is not so surprising, because she had said last year she didn't want the existing 2-year temporary sales tax hike to expire completely. She thought that was a way to save educational funding. And, of course, in this environment where you've had some cuts to public schools, cuts to the public universities, and tuition hikes, she has now again said that she intends to make that part of her proposal to the legislature for a new year budget. Representative Faison has been saying for some time that he would like to see more money in education.
How do you see this proposal? Is this something that she really thinks she can convince the Republican-controlled legislature to do, or is this just campaigning for the fall?
It's campaigning for the fall. The legislature hasn't. I mean, let me qualify that a little bit. It's certainly most likely campaigning for the fall. With her having veto power, I suppose there's a possibility of a lot of back and forth in negotiation. But what we had happen last year was the The Republicans have a veto-proof majority in the Senate. They need some Democratic votes in the House. Well, they got the five Democratic votes in the House that they needed to pass the budget. And so with the taxes expiring, and that's certainly going to be their position again. But so she may hope that maybe that doesn't happen this time, but she's also trying to clearly draw a distinction between how she sees what ought to happen and how the Republicans.
Her advisors must be telling her something that sort of surprising, I guess, in the sense that the Democrats sort of are wrapped around the Republicans are wrapped around the Democrats. This is the party of raising taxes, and so Governor Perdue proposes very forthrightly a tax increase, and isn't that a big weight against her going into the November election, that the Republicans are just going to say, look, this is the lady who wants to raise your taxes, and we're the group that wants to lower your taxes?
Well, that's certainly what their message is going to be. Her message is going to be these are the groups that this Republican legislature is the group that wants to destroy public education, and I'm the one person who is, you know, potentially going to protect the public education and prevent that from happening, especially if you elect a Republican governor. I think it's difficult to predict how those.
Well, as Bill Faison, our Orange County representative, says, this was his idea first. Can you?
Well, he's been talking about it for a while, but I think if you went back to last year, certainly the governor can say, "Look, go look at my last budget proposal. It may not be exactly the same, but certainly the basic message was the same."
Well, how would Bill Faison be as a candidate for governor based on what the a Raleigh group, the insiders. You're the editor of the Insider. What are the insiders saying about this?
Well, I think that he has the huge disadvantage of just not being very well known throughout the rest of the state. He may be known in the Triangle region, in Orange and Durham and even Wake County, but when you and Alamance and that area. Around northern Orange County, but when you start getting into other areas of the state, he's just got a huge deficit in name recognition.
Now, you're not paid to be a political consultant. I guess if you claim to be a great political consultant, you could make even more money being a consultant. But if you were, and our own Bill Faison was serious about running for governor, what kind of political advice would you give me? Would you give him? First of all, he's got a little bit of money. I mean, he's got a lot of money, really, but a little bit of money compared to what Romney or some of the other rich people who run for public office have. So, you'd have to give him some counsel about raising money. And then the other thing that political candidates have to have is that they have to have a bunch of people who love them. In the arenas where they're running, you have to go out and cultivate allies and people who organize for you. Those are the kinds of things that leap into my mind. I mean, what would you tell him he needed to do if he was really serious about running for governor?
Well, the thing that I always think of people who maybe are not that well known in public by the larger electorate is they need to come up with fresh ideas. I think he's trying to do that, but if you are the underdog, you've got to do something to capture the public's attention, and I think that always that has to involve coming up with fresh ideas and coming up with ideas that may not that you know, DG. A lot of politicians are kind of cautious. You know, people don't think of them that way, maybe, but they generally are not going to do take they're not if they don't have to be they're not going to be risk takers, But if you're the underdog, you've got to go take political risk, and a lot of times that means pursuing ideas that are and selling the public on those ideas that maybe at first blush may not seem to be the standard political fare.
Like the Ron Paul, you're talking about Ron Paul?
Well, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Look at how, you know, Ron Paul has these dedicated supporters because he talks about ideas that certainly the mainstream politicians wouldn't embrace.
So translating into advice for Representative Faison, get some ideas that will attract to you, that will bring to you some loyal supporters based not so much on you, but on your ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know what kind of ideas you could have.
I'm not going to, I don't know whether I'm going to be that specific, but.
A pot, two chickens in every pot, and I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what you do. Let's take a quick break. We're visiting with Scott Mooneyham. He's the editor of The Insider and the statewide columnist for the Capital Press Association. He covers North Carolina politics as well, better than anybody else in North Carolina. And we're going to talk to him about upcoming political developments, including some of the people who live here in and including those that have an impact on people who live in Chapel Hill. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about what's happening in Raleigh or what's happening in state politics and what impact it has on Chapel Hill and on people who live in Chapel Hill. The other person who's been in the who pops in and out of the news is one of our neighbors, John Edwards. We don't see him very much around Chapel Hill, you talk about the trial and the postponement of the trial. Let me just tell you what I've been thinking, and I'm thinking that with due concern for Senator Edwards's health, which is, as we know, is a real important factor, and the judge needs to take that into account. I sort of thought, the longer this thing is delayed, the less important it seems to be in the course of things what Senator Edwards is accused of doing. I mean, It's always been, and that the importance of kind of spanking him in public diminishes with each month that we get away from that 2008 election and his participation in it. You know, that it's kind of history, and let's move on to current things. Is that part of the trial strategy, you think, that's going on?
I don't know whether that's part of the trial strategy, D.G., but I think it's an important point. It certainly could be. As you're aware, you know, there was a news report recently that he has an irregular heartbeat, and that's what's causing the health condition that's causing the delay. You're talking about the change in as this delay, as the trial is delayed, that the immediacy fades, the sin, so to speak, fades. The other aspect of that is, given what he's accused of, a campaign violation, and I've written about this, the campaign spending has become the Wild West, and you are, the criminal allegation is that his that political supporters, their support of his, their financial support of his mistress amounted to a improper campaign donation. Well, when you see all these groups out here that are increasingly, you know, the shadow campaigns is what I call them, because they say they're independent of the candidate, and they're spending just these gobs of money that has no limit, that is outside of the traditional candidate spending, and these groups are being organized by people who are clearly associates of the candidates. You know, what, it just, you know, to my mind, it brings up things, you know, what is this case about? What is you're saying that's a campaign violation, but this other stuff isn't? To me, it boggles the mind. Nice. And, you know, obviously, John Edwards was, some of his behavior is just terrible. But regardless of what I think of that as on a moral basis, that doesn't necessarily make it criminal.
Yeah. Well, something happened last week. You remember, and maybe you didn't see this, but they're really jumping on Mitt Romney for his unaffiliated political PAC, which is just throwing out lots of money for negative ads, primarily aimed at Newt Gingrich. And so one of the reporters pressed Romney to say, why don't you just tell him to stop? And he said, oh, I couldn't do that. It's absolutely prohibited for me to communicate with my PAC. If I did that, I would go to the big house. You know, the violation of the campaign laws was going to send him to jail. And so one of the political commentators said, in criticizing Romney, said, that's the most ridiculous thing I ever heard. Who ever heard of anybody going to jail for one of these kinds of violations? They never go to jail. That's just ridiculous. And so we're not talking about exactly the same thing. But the idea that seems to be prevalent is that, and as this reporter or commentator said, look, a $100,000 fine it's going to be a fine, and you're going to have to pay a fine fine. That's all there is to it on these election law violations. Well, how are you going to get a jury to convict somebody when the widespread attitude is that the way to enforce these kinds of alleged violations is to find somebody and find the campaign and move on. What have I missed here in terms of what the prosecution really believes that it's important in this instance to get a conviction, and how do they expect to get it?
Well, I once had somebody who has been involved in several of these cases tell me, say, well, juries often do, despite what we preach about innocent until proven guilty, that in these public corruption trials, that juries often assume the person is guilty. And so I would think that prosecutors are counting on that. And I think I don't know. I mean, maybe it's unfair criticism, but it seems to me that they're counting on a jury wanting to punish John Edwards for being a bad person as opposed to committing a criminal act. But that's my view.
If you were a betting person, or an odds maker, what would you say the odds were that the prosecution could get a conviction? Just based on what we know. I mean, obviously we can't be held accountable for, for making semi-informed guesses about what's going on.
But I would think it's somewhere in the 50-50 range, generally. There's the aspect, and I mean, I think I've spoken about both aspects of it. There's the idea of, actually having to prove intent, and I know that, one of the things that Edwards' attorneys plan to do is have some election officials, folks who work for the Federal Elections Commission, come and testify on his, as expert witnesses on his behalf.
Yeah.
And they're going to be talking about the same thing I'm talking about, that if, how do you show that these gift that in giving this money to the mistress, that was intended to benefit his political campaign? I would assume their argument can be, no, this was intended to prevent him from being publicly embarrassed. And how do you draw the connections between what is what constitutes and I made the point in that, if, well, does that mean then that somebody gave him a tie for his birthday, that if he wore that tie during a debate, that amounts to a campaign contribution as well? These questions get to be kind of difficult to parse out.
Well, I would just say that that's a convincing argument for me, in that you say 50-50, I'd say 80-20 on the chances being 80-20 against a conviction. But mine's, we're both just guessing, but we've been, if I were the defense, I'd try to get a clip of that. Political commentator said, big house, no, you don't go to the big house for this kind of violation. This is, this is somewhere you pay a fine. And see if that couldn't corrupt the jury, the jury's deliberations on this. One of the things that's, just to show you how bad a predictor I am, I would have just said, with respect to Newt Gingrich's private life and the publicity of his private life, if you'd asked me a year ago if he could ever be a candidate for anything with those kinds of public censures and then his private life shenanigans earlier on, that he would never, ever be, he could never run for political office again. And yet the passage of time and the living a clean life for a little while and being a pretty smart cookie has made him at least a player in the current election, far beyond what I would have predicted. And so that leads to the question about John Edwards, who a year ago, and maybe even today, people would say this guy, he may not get convicted, but his political life is over forever. Is there a chance that with a little bit of rehabilitation and confession and service that, we can't deny that he isn't a persuasive and attractive political candidate, that there might be some future in politics for him, or is it all over?
I don't think so. I think it's probably all over, and I would say this about Newt Gingrich. You could certainly make the point, and he has been he's garnered votes, but did he ever have any chance of winning this election? I would argue no, and so I think the things that you're talking about, his past personal life, I don't think he ever had any legitimate shot to win, despite what some of these polls may have shown. I'm not a big believer in the polls until voters don't get focused on elections until they're a few weeks out. So I don't put a lot of stock in polls until an election's actually approaching. And so if you see, you can go back and you can look at the polls in Iowa or the polls in New Hampshire, or these polls that were, a few months out of the prior to the holidays. Newt Gingrich has momentum. What happened to that momentum? I would argue it was never there in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're visiting with Scott Minahan. We're talking about politics, North Carolina and other. And he and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Scott Minahan is my guest. He covers North Carolina politics for The Insider. He's the editor of The Insider, which is sort of a weekday morning report to insiders about insider activities, delivered by the internet, and it's a very important staple for those people who deal with state government. And he's also a statewide political columnist for the Capital Press Association, and my good friend, because he'll come and counsel me on state politics and counsel us here in Chapel Hill. We talked about Chapel Hill, our Orange County people, Bill Faison and John Edwards. Talk to us, Joe Hackney, the former Speaker of the House, and another one of our state legislators, continues to be in the news as sort of the leader of the opposition. And is how's Joe doing over there?
Well, I'm not sure that he is happy in his role. When you go from being Speaker to the minority leader, it's I'm sure not a not a fun process. And you know, in the House in particular has always been kind of a raucous place, more so than the Senate. And so in this legislative session, you have had the Republicans now in control. They are kind of serving up their pent-up, I don't know whether anger would be the right term, but certainly they're ready to exercise their power now, and they have, and to the chagrin of Representative Hackney. And so this 2011 was filled with these long debates in the House where it was pretty clear what was going to happen. The Republicans were going to get their way, but the Democrats, and led by former Speaker Hackney, would make these long speeches and talk about why these ideas being pursued by the Republicans were going to be bad for the state. And, you know, at times the arguments were, they needed to be made, you know, to make their points known, they're trying to make the public aware of what, how they view these legislation. But at times the debate got very shrill.
Well, just you talked about redistricting a few minutes ago as something that's up in the air, and Representative Hackney and Representative Insko, who represent this area, have if the current districts under the current district plan, and if the elections were held or to be held in May as scheduled. Democrats would have to in this area would have to decide between Representative Hackney and Representative Insko unless one of them chose not to run. And so people in Chapel Hill haven't really thought about that a lot. But what would you tell them about the likelihood that those districts are going to hold up under the challenge that Democrats and others have brought in the courts? And how does all that? Can you explain to us what the legal issues are?
Well, it's pretty complicated. Anybody explaining election law and the Voting Rights Act and what that means? I don't know if the Supreme Court justices understand that. But the bottom line is, as you say, these lawsuits have been filed challenging the districts that were drawn by Republicans 10 years ago. We had this same process, except the roles were reversed. And at that time, elected primary was delayed both in 2002 and 2004. I think there's a strong possibility that the primaries will be delayed this year as well. The groups that have filed the lawsuits have asked a three-panel judge is hearing the lawsuit.
This is a federal judge.
No, this is a three-panel state judges.
And at what level are they? Trial judges?
They
or
are superior, they are superior three superior court judges, you know, their rulings, I'm sure, will be appealed.
Is it a panel?
It is a panel.
It'll be one case. All this stuff consolidated into one case, and it's a three trial judge panel. This is a little bit unusual, isn't it?
This is different than the past. What happened after in the 2002 case? A Johnson County Superior Court judge was the trial level judge. The Democrats, of course, were still in control of the legislature at the time. They were unhappy with the process. They felt like the Republicans had gone judge shopping with their in getting this case before a judge that would be sympathetic to them. And so one of the things the Democrats did in response to that was pass legislation that created a regime for when these lawsuits would be filed in the future, so that you would have a three-judge panel created and where they would reside and who would Sarah Parker, the North Carolina Chief Justice, is the person who appointed them, and so in their minds they were creating a more impartial process, and so that is where it stands now. That the Republican state and Republican legislature have asked that the lawsuit be thrown out. And the other day they heard arguments about dismissing the lawsuit. I kind of doubt that happens. I mean, generally, given the gravity of it, I would assume that this will go at least to the stage of what they call summary judgment, and then probably forward from there. And like I say, there will likely be appeals, and then does this end up before the federal courts as well? Because there are conflicting state and federal laws regarding elections and district lines that have to be melded together.
And so will there be then a separate federal lawsuit brought in federal court, or is that will be an appeal to the federal courts after the state?
I think it would be an appeal to the federal court based on some state ruling at some point.
On the basis of a constitution. So you would appeal to the state Supreme Court ruling ultimately, and then an appeal to the an appeal from a state Supreme Court ruling. Well, I don't know. We'd have to look. I thought that would go directly to the Supreme Court. So you're talking about a long period of time, and I'm talking about something I don't know anything about. But it's more confusing than, I guess what I'm saying is that you've told me it's more confusing than I thought it was going to be, and that because it's confusing, I'll go along with your prediction that maybe we'd have to adjust to a revised primary schedule so that this confusing legal situation could get sorted out.
That's right. My recollection is in 2002 that the primaries were delayed until September, and in 2004, this case continued. And in 2004, that the primaries were delayed into July. So this wasn't resolved until 2004.
Well, assuming the districts as drawn are upheld.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about my impression that this was done so carefully to tilt the advantage to Republicans in securing a majority in the state legislature, that it would be very hard, even in a Democratic year, for Democrats to retake control of the legislature. And am I right about that, or are things changing so much that you just can't redistrict a majority of the people out of the legislative process?
Well, I think that it would be very difficult for certainly these districts are drawn to give Republicans an advantage. And if you go back to the 1990 maps, if you were to look at those, they were pretty crazy too.
Uh-huh.
They were drawn all over the place to give Democrats an advantage. The court process from the last time actually did did result in more compact districts. But as far as what that means going forward, if these maps were to hold, I think even if the maps were to be overturned, that Republicans would control the continue to control the Senate. The Democrats were able to keep control of the Senate for such a long time by having candidates who in several districts who were, you know, they were
pro-business conservatives.
That's correct. Yeah. Yes, pro-business conservatives who were very popular among Republicans within their districts. People like David Hoyle in Gaston County. So now that those districts have swung Republican, they're not gonna. I wouldn't think that those many of those districts would change, whether the maps hold or not. And if the districts hold, certainly it gives Republicans an advantage. But you have to think that, particularly as it regards to the House, you've got 120 districts. How do you, if you make one district stronger, do you weaken another one? And I'm just not convinced yet that the Republicans in this past election in the House, part of their majority, rest on the fact that they had a lot of success in eastern North Carolina. And I'm just not yet convinced that even though, you know, that's been when you get east of 95, before you get to the coast, kind of the traditional Jesse-crat stronghold, I'm just not convinced yet that people down there are going to continue to vote, even though these maps give the Republicans an advantage. I'm just not convinced that those folks are going to continue just because they voted more Republican last time, that they're going to vote more Republican this time.
Well, we're visiting with Scott Mooneyham. We're talking about state politics and how it impacts things here in Chapel Hill. He and I will be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Scott Mooneyham, who is the editor of The Insider, the daily report on state politics that insiders get. And he's also the statewide columnist for the Capital Press Association dealing with state politics. And he's my go-to man when I've got questions about state politics. Scott, you wrote an article. The tuition matter is now before the Board of Governors. I just have to say, you know, I'm a low tuition guy, but around here the sentiment is, gosh, we got to protect quality even at the expense of making it more expensive for students to go to college. You wrote a fairly strong column recently, and I understand President Friday that you and President Friday have talked about it, and y'all are in agreement about this. How did you come down on the side of low tuition?
Well, I'm a native, and I remember growing up here in the 70s, and, you know, everyone that time, North Carolina and California were the two states that everybody talked about as the low tuition states. And, you know, D.G., I've just always been, I certainly understand that the folks at the universities, they're looking out for their institutions, but I think low tuition is a much broader policy issue than as it relates to solely to the universities themselves. I believe that, first of all, I think that what North Carolina is part of a result of being a low tuition state. I don't know that, you know, the Triangle and the Greensboro, Winston's, the Triad, and Charlotte, that those areas would be the thriving areas that they are if this state did not have that reputation as a low tuition state that brought people here from all over the country, and a big percentage of them, when they got here, they stayed here. It attracted bright minds to this to this state. And so that's always been my position.
I remember President Spangler used to say, look, they pay high tuition. They just pay for it after they get out of school and they get these high-paying jobs, and then they pay more taxes than they would have paid if they hadn't gotten this high level of education. I wish we had more time. Maybe we can come back and talk about this argument, because it's not just an argument between the universities and the students about it. It is, as you point out, a big public policy issue that we ought to talk about. And I haven't left enough time to talk about it. I apologize. Will you come back sometime soon and we'll talk about it some more?
Absolutely.
Thanks for a great education about some of the things in North Carolina politics that concern us here in Chapel Hill. Scott Minahan, those of us who live in Chapel Hill are grateful for what you do and for sharing your wisdom with us.
Thank you.
And thanks to you for listening. This has been Who's Talking. I'm D.G. Martin, and I'll be back here before you know it.